It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
All right. Welcome to the latest edition of the Radio Hour, and our guest today doesn't need a lot of introduction. So, Jeff, let's do this. Let's get right into things and welcome Joe Satriani to the program. Welcome, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing real good, man. It's a real pleasure to have you here on the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, let's get into things, man. Let's talk about this new record. You've released some interesting records over the years that I point to as mile markers on your journey. And The Extremist is an obvious one that Jeff and I were talking about. And I also would throw in your self-titled album from 1995 as another example. This new record feels like another interesting shift for you just from a sonic standpoint. There's a lot of headroom and a lot of room to breathe in the recording of it, and it doesn't feel overly processed. Can you share a little bit of insight with us as far as where you wanted to go with this one?
Well, yeah, you know, you're right. I have tested the patience of my fans by releasing different kinds of records. But, you know, since back in 85, I guess, 84, 85. And each time, you know, we get into the studio, there's lots of things going on that we'd love to accomplish. You know, there's broad musical directions, and then there's all the stuff that's really sort of like in the micro world where you're thinking, this time I only want to use effects boxes that are, you know, no bigger than, you know, 3x3. Or you decide you're just going to use tape, or you're just going to use digital, or you're going to use microphones, by themselves, or you're going to make sure that you put 7 mics on every speaker and then, you know, mix them in the studio. So there's a lot of stuff going on that we love to do, and we do that mainly because the art of recording is so much fun. This time around, you know, I did bring in some new players. And so I got together with engineer and co-producer Mike Fraser with the idea that let's make sure that we keep the recording open enough to capture what they want to bring to the sessions. And you never know, you know. So a guy like Vinny Colaiuta can play anything. But you want to make sure that when you're all in the room together, that you record it in a way that allows his performance to breathe. And, you know, you don't sort of put him in a cage the first day he shows up. And so that was our idea, was really just to see what would happen in a more organic style of recording.
How did you manage to make your schedule work with Vinny's to get him on this record? That had to be there had to be some gymnastics involved.
Yeah, you know, I knew going into it that I probably was only going to, you know, lasso him down for, you know, 8 to 10 days. And as it happened, you know, he was finishing up with Sting. He was getting over, I think, pneumonia, happening at the end of the year. And so I had contacted him in November, which was kind of late, you know, leading up to my sessions. And I said, you know, all I need is like, you know, 7 to 10 days. It's 16 tracks, but I knew that he'd be able to knock out quite a few per day. And so, you know, he was able to just sort of fit me in, and that's what he did. He showed up, he played brilliantly, and he had enough time to go back home and kick back and, I don't know, do another 100 records and a couple more tours. He's pretty superhuman. Chris Chaney was pretty much the same way. He's a very much in-demand session player in LA, and of course he's in Jane's Addiction, so he's, you know, constantly writing and doing all sorts of stuff with those guys. But it was kind of fun to have that limit placed upon me, a little bit of a schedule to bring, you know, up the energy level, the anxiety level a bit, to make sure that I get all my stuff together and present the music to them in a strong fashion. Because I think that if someone told me, you know, you've got 6 months, I would have spent all of it. and I'm not sure it would come out any better, but, you know, so I think putting some limits on time and budget is a good idea.
What did both of those guys bring to the table for you as far as where you wanted to go with the material on this record?
Well, surprises. I mean, that's a really good question, because that what they brought, besides the obvious, you know, we all know they can play like crazy. I knew I sort of had this instinctual feeling that Vinny was going to surprise me, and I thought that's what I need right now. I need to bring in, you know, out of the 60 songs that I wrote, I wanted to bring in 16 that put me scratching my head a little bit as far as how to do it, and then hand that, you know, part of that decision over to this band and say, here's my demo, now how would you like to hear it? And I thought, I bet he's going to surprise me, and I'm just going to be rehearsed and ready to follow him. I had the same feeling, you know, about Chris, because I knew Chris, I knew would be able to play anything, but what I was counting on and what he delivered was keen sense of tone. You know, he would listen to, again, the demos, he'd listen to how Vinny was going to interpret it, and he'd always just stay in that spot that, to me, was like being the ultimate rock bass player. Like, he never got too esoteric. He knew that instinctually that I'm just a rock and roll generation guitar player, so he made sure that everything stayed rockin' no matter where Vinny took it. And then, of course, Mike Keneally is just so brilliant. You know, virtuoso on both guitar and keyboard. So he can listen to what I'm doing and understand what it is I'm trying to do. And he's always there to answer, to elaborate, and he can play all this stuff live. So you just, with all these guys, you know, we would record like 6 or 7 takes, and there would be so many great performances. If we didn't have one where we were all shining, you know, we you know, grab my solo from take 4 and we put it with Vinny's performance from take 6 and you know, Mike Keneally's from take 5. And so there was some mix and matching if we didn't all fire at the same time.
You said something about the other guys being able to hear what you're trying to do. And that makes me want to ask you, to what extent you feel like you're in command of your craft at this point? You know, do you feel like you've got a really good grip on it, or are you just still fumbling along like everybody else?
Yeah, I was going to say flailing away, but you said fumbling. That's right. Yeah, I think guitar still feels like a piece of work to me. I mean, I'm always practicing, trying to make it feel more comfortable, more familiar. I'm not sure that ever will happen. You know, I think from the reaction I get from people around me is that when I'm having a hard time and I'm sweating and I'm trying really hard and I think I'm way out on a limb, people are looking at me thinking that I'm doing really good, and they want to keep that stuff. And so, you know, and then on the other side of it is that when I feel comfortable and I think I'm playing great, I notice people kind of not paying attention. So I figure, well, there must be something in the struggle that's worth recording, you know. So although it's very hard to get used to that, I've just learned to live with it.
That's a good way to put it, something worth capturing in the struggle. What is your practice routine at this point? I'm always curious about guys who have logged as many hours as you, because there are guys like Jerry Douglas who say that what looks like practicing from the outside is really just him warming up and making sure that all the synapses are still firing the way they're supposed to. But yeah. I know that you've taught a lot. And so I would imagine that practice and trying to improve your playing is probably more a part of your routine than maybe some other players.
You know, I think that as the years have gone on, that you know, after you finish like learning where things are and all the different chords and scales and things like that, and you know, you've passed that 3 to 6 year mark, you know, there isn't a whole lot that's gonna develop in terms of you know, brute speed, or
right.
There aren't any more ways to rearrange 12 notes, you know, I mean. At some point you get to the end of that cycle and you go, wow, I've learned every scale, every chord, and I think this is probably as fast as I'm ever going to go, so now what's left? And what's left is what people want to hear. because nobody wants to hear that other stuff. They certainly don't want to hear practicing. They just want to hear real music. So that's, to me, that's when the real work begins. You really got to concentrate on writing great music and learning how to perform in a way that really moves people. That's the hardest thing to practice because there isn't any exercise for it.
Right.
So there are two ways to practice for I think any player who's accomplished, you know, who's a player that's gone through beginner, intermediate, and advanced stages. And that is, you know, stay familiar with what you got to do. Focus on things that are coming up, let's say in a show that maybe you haven't played in a long time. So for me, like yesterday, I was very slowly going over a song called The Mystical Potato Head Groove Thing, because it's got these strange arpeggios that when I recorded them, I was just sitting down and I could just sit there and wait for them to come and fire them off. But on stage, I have to play the arpeggios, and they're inserted in between melody and rhythm guitar. It's extremely unusual to have to whip out that arpeggio. And so I find that if it's going to be back in the set list for a tour, I need about 3 weeks of going over it, you know, maybe 15 minutes, 4 or 5 times a day.
Wow.
I just do it really slowly, make sure it's really clean, make sure I'm using my fingertips, you know, make sure my neck is relaxed, my shoulders aren't hunched, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, by the time I hit the stage, I feel very confident that I'm going to be able to, you know, fire them off when necessary. So that's like a specific thing that I would do.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, it's just like, you know, how do you feel and how do you put that feeling into music, and can that turn into a song? And that, to me, is what should occupy the composing musician's day most of the time.
That's really interesting to hear you talk about a song like that that's been in your catalog for so long. But I think that that really speaks to something that's been a part of your career and your playing for a long time, which is just how much it seems, whether you're in the studio or playing live, you're always coordinating a lot of things. Like, you know, in those early years, you know, making the stuff that you were recording in the studio translate to the stage, which, if I recall correctly, and I'm just reaching from memory, which, as Jeff will tell you, is sometimes my sometimes my worst thing. But I recall that, like, the early shows, there was a lot of you, you know, playing along with like a sequenced part to be able to duplicate like a couple guitar parts, or in some cases, just figuring out how to make those two or three guitar parts into one guitar part on stage.
Yeah, I think we had, you know, the first tour we went out, Stu Hamm, Jonathan Mover, and myself, we had a limited amount of material, you know, just 2 albums worth of songs, and not really all of them were even appropriate for playing in front of a club audience or a theater audience. So we're dealing with maybe an album and a half worth of material. We had to stretch out a lot of material. Most of the stuff got kind of power trio infused. But there were maybe 2 or 3 songs where we would use either some triggers. I think we had some old Akai sampler so that we could do something like Lords of Karma or The Crush of Love and have those guitar chords come in. And I think in the following tour, we had the Flying in a Blue Dream chords also it triggered, which was really kind of a haphazard kind of way of doing it. Eventually, we, you know, in using either Logic Audio or Pro Tools, we were able to stick this stuff on a laptop and then an iPad, which has been the most reliable way to do it since there are no moving parts, you know. And that seems to help. But it seems to me that we've only maybe done 2 to 3 songs out of a, you know, 2-hour and 45-minute show tops that have any background tracks, because they kind of tie you in, you know, to an arrangement. You can't do any improvising when you've got something to play along with, you know, that's automated.
Right.
So I think now, I believe it's only Flying in a Blue Dream that we've kept automated, only because those acoustic guitar chords are so captivating. You know what I mean? They tell you right away where you're going with the song. And I've toured without, you know, that backing track once or twice, and I thought it's not the same. And it's kind of a nice treat for the audience to hear something from the record, you know, maybe once in an evening's performance. So, yeah, but it's funny. It's great that that technology is around. I mean, most pop performers, of course, the entire concert is being generated from Pro Tools, and they're just doing live singing and play on top. But, you know, I don't really care one way or the other. It's the show. That's what it is. It's entertainment. They're recordings of people playing and programming and making musical decisions. So it's just as valid as a guy standing up there playing a kick drum and a harmonica. But I think it's really about, does it really make the musicians feel more free, you know, and will it allow them to give a better performance? Sometimes it does.
While we're talking about this tour, both Matt and I agree that one thing that guitar freaks need to know about this tour is that you've got Steve Morse opening for you.
Yeah.
And yeah. That's great. That's awesome. And great opening acts is something that I feel like we've been able to kind of count on from you in an industry where the opening act is sometimes almost an afterthought. You know, they don't always make this much sense, but what else could a guitar fan ask for?
That's right. Yeah. Explosions, free money, dancing girls. which I'm not saying we don't have those things. I'm just saying, you know, but I've done quite a bit of touring with Steve, and he is somebody I look up to. He's such a unique guitar player, an accomplished musician, a great composer, and he's such a fun guy to play with. He's very open and generous and relaxed. At the same time, he's got that intense, fiery way of playing. He's really just a great guy to hang around with. And of course, he's got Dave in the band, and Dave has toured with me before as a bass player, and he's an amazing bass player. So it's a great feeling when you know that you've got a tour going where both bands have got a lot to say musically, and they've got a lot of great musicianship to back up, you know, what they're bringing. It just makes you feel good about going to the gig every night. Yeah,
and this was, I guess I was particularly excited about him being paired up with you on this run, just because, you know, as you know, I mean, he's so busy with Deep Purple stuff so much of the time, like it's really kind of a real treat to get a chance to see a Steve Morse show for, you know, most of us here in the States.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, getting all of our schedules together is difficult. Sometimes, you know, you really have your heart set on touring with somebody and you know, they've either got prior commitments on their own or working with another band, and Steve Morse is one of those guys. He's very busy. I think he's got about two or three bands going. But luckily, we're all pretty much acquainted. You know, I can call up the guys in Deep Purple and we can argue about when we get Steve Morse.
Well, I want to ask about that real quick, you know, because there's an interesting tie-in there that a lot of folks know about, but not everybody's going to know about, and that is the time that you spent playing with Deep Purple before Steve ended up, you know, ultimately taking the gig. You had a shot at that gig. It didn't work out politically, if I understand correctly. What are your reflections looking back at that time period? Is that something you would have, you know, liked to have pursued, or did things work out for the best for you with where things have gone?
Yeah, playing with Deep Purple was great. That was a dream come true. But I kind of had the feeling going into it, like, how can this possibly, you know, move forward? I'd been pretty lucky being a guitar player that kind of burst on the scene as a solo artist, although it seemed like it took forever. You know, I didn't really start becoming a recording artist till I was 30, so that seems like, you know, usually when people pack it in. So it came late to me, so that sort of added to my feeling like, wow, I've got these, you know, a set of platinum records, and I've got offers to tour around the world, and Sony wants me to make a lot more records for them, and it's like, why would I want to suddenly leave that and join a band where I have to replace Ritchie Blackmore of all people? You know? 'Cause I thought I'd be stuck playing Ritchie Blackmore songs for the rest of my career, because he just did it. He did it so well that there's no point in trying to redo it. So I thought, do I really want to do that? Now I've had friends who have been in that position, most notably Steve Vai, who always told me, he'd say, Joe, whatever you can do, avoid replacing somebody famous, because that was the bane of his existence for a part of his career. He was always replacing somebody. And he would just get a lot of hell for it, you know. And he's a very unique individual, and it took him a while to break out of that, you know, being the guy that replaced Warren in Zappa, replaced Yngwie, and then went on to sort of replace Eddie Van Halen when David Lee Roth put his solo act together. And then in Whitesnake with John Sykes. So, you know, he had enough of that. And I remember just thinking, like, I'm a big fan of Ritchie Blackmore. How am I ever going to get used to hearing me when what I really want to hear is Ritchie Blackmore? So, you know, towards the end of that second tour I did with him in the summer of 94, I remember sitting down with Roger Glover in a bar in Barcelona, and we really had to just figure out, like, what is going to happen, because I was a big fan of the band and I wanted to see them continue, and they were at a crossroads. They needed somebody to come in and help them renew themselves. And out of that conversation came the name Steve Morse, and we were both looking at each other like, that would be amazing, because Steve Morse can write like crazy, and he's so different. He's like so American compared to, let's say, Ritchie, who is so very British. And they really were attracted to that idea. And so from that conversation, they were very fortunate that, that Steve was amenable to the idea. And I think he's really helped keep the band alive push them into territory where they could, you know, still contribute some really cool stuff. They got a new record coming out any moment now, don't they?
Yeah, it's out.
Oh, it is out.
Okay, yep.
Cool. Hey, speaking of going from being a solo artist to being in a band, we should probably talk for a couple of minutes about Chickenfoot. But I wanted to start just by asking you how you manage your songwriting, given that you're, running a solo career as well as a membership in Chickenfoot, how you kind of mentally parcel out your material as you write it.
Yeah, I like the way you said that, membership in Chickenfoot, because, you know, we joke around that we are the gentlemen of the foot, an old musician's gentleman's club, you know, kind of sit around smoking cigars and drinking Armagnac. But yes. It's really a lot of fun writing for those guys, because I don't really have to complete anything. You know, I could bring in a couple of riffs or a complete structure and a funny title. And, you know, I'm just assuming that Sam's going to throw a lot of it away, and, and Chad will turn the beat around and Mike will come up with an alternate riff. But that's part of the fun, is mixing up with guys and having them bring a fresh attitude into, you know, to something that really is just a demo. So it's been great. It's been like just having this other creative outlet that that I really love participating in, and it's important to me. I take it very seriously.
I think a lot of people were really surprised at how well you can fit into a traditional band setting as a guitar player without an overload of riffs per second like some people might expect. How different was that for you from some of the band configurations that you've already been a part of with your own solo band?
Yeah, I think, it is obviously, you kind of, you know, hit the nail on the head there. I've got to leave room for the band to be themselves. And it's not really like, it's not, let's say, like Van Halen, where obviously there's a huge spot reserved for Eddie to just dazzle us, you know. and you know, there are some sort of roadblocks here and there, as it is with any group of people. Like, for instance, Chad does not like heavy metal. He really doesn't like modern kind of metal at all. And there's part of me that's a big fan. So I realize, well, there are certain things that, you know, he won't be happy with if I'm writing them into these pieces. And Sam is also one of those guys who he likes to have things to do in a song. And so even when I'm soloing, I know that Sam's going to want to yell or scream or get people. You know what I mean? And I guess I thought, you know, on my solo shows, I play all the melodies and all the solos on every single song. So maybe in this band, I kind of, you know, I relax a little bit, you know, and I treat it a little bit more like, you know, like Led Zeppelin or Black Sabbath or something, where it's a bit more traditional in the sense that we, you know, we're using riffs and we're using the rhythm section like a freight train. And so it's more like we're a unit and less like there's a background band and a superstar guitar player who's going to play over everything, you know?
Right, right.
And I, you know, I was part of it. I was reacting to just what we did naturally. But then the other thing I thought, you know, I'm a big Van Halen fan. So it was the last thing I want to do is sort of, you know, step on Eddie's shoes and what he did with Sam and Mike. And you know, I mean, let me tell you how easy it would be, because you've got half of Van Halen right there in the room with you. And a couple of times, you know, Chad and I would just, you know, launch into a Van Halen song, and it's just sick. How, you know, to fall into that, but we had to like resist and say, let's, you know, let's back that and not go there. So in the same way, we don't try to imitate the Chili Peppers, and you know, we're not doing Satchel Paige or anything like that in the Chickenfoot shows. We're trying to keep the band, you know, focused on its identity as an original four piece.
Yeah, and I think that was a big thing that really stood out to me, and I actually talked to Michael Anthony about this, I guess it's been a couple years ago now, but just how you guys went out and really, you know, certainly for Michael and for Sammy, you know, it was the first time that they had been in the club setting in a long time, you know, playing nothing but an album's worth of new material that, you know, that people weren't necessarily as familiar with as they were with the stuff from their, you know, primary projects. You know, you can also put, you know, Chad in there, and certainly yourself, I guess, really all four of you guys, it's been a long time since you've had to like face that proving ground. So it was really, that showed a lot of confidence, obviously, in the material that you guys were going out with.
Well, that was, you know, I suppose the most interesting part of the challenge of launching a new band. You know, even though we had a pedigree, you know, there was especially the other guys in the band. I mean, we're talking about guys who play stadiums and who have multi-platinum credits behind them and Grammys and all sorts of awards. But at the same time, when you're a new band, you're a new band. And the music industry has a way of slapping you back into place. And so we realized, well, you know what, let's find out if we can make a club with 400 people in it really rock, and then let's move on up. And so that's what we did. We spent about 2 or 3 weeks, you know, playing those ridiculously small places, and then we moved up to the theaters, and then we headed over to Europe and we started doing some festivals. So it was condensed, you know. We took what maybe takes a band 5 years, and we did it in 5 months. But we only had a limited amount of time, because between Chad, Sam, and myself, we do have other things to do. Fitting that all into the schedule meant that we had to do everything small. So they were mini tours, you know, that we were going on. But the overall experience was great. I mean, playing those club shows was just a real great experience, a lot of fun, high energy, you know. I'm glad we did it.
I want to tie what we're talking about here in with the new material, and say that one of the real pleasures for me from those Chickenfoot records was hearing so much of your personality come out in the rhythm guitar. You know, like you said, you hung back. You know, it wasn't all about the solos all the time, and it was, as Matt alluded to, there were people who maybe were surprised that you were willing to do that. And I wonder, based on the live feel and the kind of the heavier feel of the new record, if working with those guys has bled into your songwriting at all, you know, if it informed the new material at all.
I think, you know, one thing that's for sure is that whatever you do, it has an influence on you. So yeah. Whether you know you go out and decide to take a vacation for 9 months, or you play with a bunch of different bands, eventually it has some sort of a influence. I'm not quite sure if it's like, you know, you play with a blues band for a week and you go home and you write a blues song, or you play with a blues band for a week and you come home and you say, I will never do that again. You know, sometimes there's all sorts of things that go on with that. But I think the biggest plus for me was just having such a great time with other musicians who play differently. And I think that's something that every musician will tell you is a great thing to experience. It just going out with, let's say, a different rhythm section who, you know, has a different way of feeling the beat, laying, you know, how they play on time, how they like to play in the backbeat, how they like to slow down and how they like to race ahead. All of that is, you know, part and parcel of what makes a unit have its unique personality. And you really never know what it's like until you do it. I mean, wouldn't it be great if you could, you know, play with John Bonham and John Paul Jones? I mean, you would imagine, you'd fantasize, wow, it's like I'm Jimmy Page all of a sudden. Never get there, but the effect is that, you know, I think that there's probably nobody else who's ever played with those guys. You think about it, only Jimmy made all those records with that rhythm section. But think, you know, how different it would have sounded had those two guys gone out and made records with Clapton or Beck, you know, or Brian May, or, you know, Billy Gibbons. I mean, it would be so profoundly different. And so I looked at it that way, like, wow, I'm playing with the bass player from Van Halen, and I've got the drummer from the Chili Peppers, you know, and this is going to make me play differently. It's going to give experience that's going to be, you know, part of my musical personality from here on out, because I've experienced it. So that's the way I look at it.
That's a good way to put it. How quickly did the songs on the new record come together? I mean, are they all from the past few years, or did you have some lying around longer than that?
Is this the solo record or the last Chickenfoot record?
No, the new solo record.
I think, see if I really, there were 16 songs, right? So there's a good number that were written within, let's say, the 12 months leading up to the recording.
Okay.
There was one that was supposed to be a Chickenfoot song, but they didn't like it, which was turned out to be our single, A Door Into Summer. I thought certainly that it would be something unique for Chad, Mike, and I to be pounding the four on the floor thing, and Sam could be maybe like talking during the verses and then singing a chorus. But it just, that day, they looked at me like I was nuts. So I just kind of put the song back in my pocket, and thankfully I had it for the solo record. There were a few songs that went way back to 88. We recorded them.
Wow.
But in the end, I thought, you know what, I think I just needed to record them, but I don't think I want to hear them anymore. So they were not included on the record. They most likely will be, you know, bonus tracks when we release the box set next year. But it's funny how that is sometimes. You record songs thinking they're the most important, you know, artistic parts of your life. And then once you hear them, you go, oh, okay, I'm over that. You know, maybe I just needed to finish it, you know. And so they're more cathartic in how they operate in your creative life, not necessarily something you want to show people, but something that you need to experience. So, you know, other than that, you know, the title track, most of what's on there is actually stuff that was written in between the three G3 tours and Chickenfoot Montreux shows and all of last year. Last year was crazy. Tours. And so every time I come home for a couple of weeks, I'd be there, you know, writing some new material.
Well, I'm glad you said the words box set, because I wanted to ask about that. And I want to ask from the diehard fan's perspective, the guy that has everything, couple things. How much rare unreleased stuff is going to be on there? And then how much does this tie in with your recently announced memoir?
The box set we've been working on for about a year, John Cuniberti has been remastering everything. And you know, he's recorded about half of it anyway. He has been really absolutely meticulous in going over each of these recordings, rescuing the tapes, baking tapes, finding the outtakes and all that kind of stuff. Epic Sony has been fantastic in giving us the green light to make the master compilation here. It'll have a lot of outtakes, previously unreleased tracks, but more importantly, it'll have a remastering job for the records that, you know, went all the way back, recordings all the way back to 84. So there's a lot of music to cover there. It's odd how things happen coincidentally, but just about the time we started doing that, Jake Brown, a guy who's written maybe 30 books on the music industry and specifically about different artists and bands, approached me with the idea of writing some kind of a book, and we came up with the idea of focusing on each album and meticulously going over each song, equipment, interviewing all the engineers, producers, musicians, just about everyone who had anything to do with any of the records. And then there's also going to be, in the beginning of the book, a good amount of biography, but it's not going to be like, you know, a tell-all autobiography. I haven't gotten in enough trouble yet to write one. So we're going to keep it focused on the music. And it does turn out that it's going to be a great companion to the box set that's coming out, and I think it'll, you know, we're sort of diversifying in what we've been offering our fans. You know, this year we started offering up a book, a small book of some of my drawings for people who pre-ordered Unstoppable Momentum. Those things just flew out the door, and I think we're going to be doing a postcard book of a limited amount of those drawings as well later on tour. And then I think to coincide with all this stuff coming out next year, we're going to make sure they're all available. So, yeah, it's kind of crazy when you think about it, all the stuff that we're working on. But I'm very excited about it.
Now, you mentioned remastering the old stuff. Is this going to lead into single album reissues?
I'm not sure how they do that now. I mean, as you know, it's such an unusual shift we're going through right now. I think still, you know, the industry is still wondering, like, where is it really going to go? I think it was a bit clearer when, you know, cassettes came out or when CDs came out. Even when stuff started to happen online, people sort of figured out, okay, this is what we need to do. But right now we're in that funny period where no one's quite sure about when to jump off the CD, you know?
Right.
And even though people are saying vinyl's coming back, it's not coming back. We all that's sort of like me saying my hair is growing back. It's just not happening. So I think I think we'll address that. I think things change so quickly that 6 months from now we may have a different opinion on whether it's worth actually repackaging and, you know, putting on a vinyl or a CD, this separate thing. Right now we're working on an unusual way of delivering the box set, and I don't even want to call it a box set, but we have no other phrase that makes any sense. But I'll let you know once we figure that out. But it's
all right.
Be something different.
Well, final bit here, and then we'll let you run, because I could talk to you about all sorts of stuff, but we want to let you get going. Where do you see the next Chickenfoot record going?
Good question there. I know I'm supposed to, you know, have lunch or dinner with Sam sometime in the next 2 weeks, and we were going to really sort of, you know, put our heads together and come up with a plan. I know that, you know, I'm keeping the Christmas and the first couple of months of next year open for recording the record. And Sammy and I have been trading song ideas for the last 6 months anyway, so we've got some things sort of in the fire. But I think what I'll do is, what I've done both times is I present the guys with lots of demos. You know, I'll bring in maybe 16 songs, and you know, half of them they hate, but or they're indifferent about. But then, as long as they can, you know, they like 10 of them, you know, then we go from there. And it's always seemed to work out that way. If I bring the stuff in first, and then they all listen to it, and then we see where it's going. So I've started, like on the last record, there was so much stuff that was in, going in different directions. There was stuff like Bigfoot, and there were little acoustic things that, you know, took on a life of their own. So I'll see what happens. I'll write a variety of material, and then I'll lay it on them, see what happens, see how they react.
Well, thank you very much, man. This was a lot of fun. We want to let you run so you can go and do other interviews and all that kind of stuff and check on workers. But, you know, thanks for setting aside some time to talk shop.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, thanks a lot, guys. It's been fun talking to you.
All right, man. Have a good one.